Spring turkey season is upon us, and don't be caught out in the woods without having Onyx Hunt on your phone. One feature Onyx has that is often overlooked for turkey hunting is their recent imagery filter with their elite memberships. This imagery is updated week to week, and it comes in extremely handy, especially when you're trying to find these gobble zones where these turkeys will go out in a high spot on a fresh clear cut and strut around all day long. Actually, I was just looking at it on Onyx where the timber company just came into Andrew's Club and did a very small clear cut along this creek. And I can see the high spots on the topographical map, but also I can see exactly where they mulch. And those are going to be hot spots for finding gobblers, especially mid-morning after they get off their hens, getting up on these little high spots in this fresh, small clear cut along the creek and strutting and gobbling all day long. If you want to give Onyx a try, you can actually download it for free, try it for 7 days. And if you decide to purchase, you can use the promo code Southern and save on your premium and elite memberships. So going into this turkey season, know where you stand with Onyx.
If you're looking to throw some optics on your turkey gun this spring, look no further than the Vortex Defender ST. This is the red dot we're going to be running this season. We're excited about it. This thing's built like a tank, super lightweight, super long battery life, everything you need in a good turkey red dot. And if you want to get a discount on that red dot or any other Vortex optic, go to eurooptic.com and use the code SGN10 to get a discount. That's eurooptic.com, code SGN10. If you live in the Gulf Coast region, you need to find yourself at the EcoWild Expo May 10th through the 12th in Mobile. It is the premier outdoor expo for the Gulf Coast region, and we're going to be there. We're going to have a booth. We're super excited about it. Can't wait to meet you guys that live down there. We absolutely love the Gulf Coast region, so to be a part of this show, we're super excited about. We're going to have past podcast guests there at our booth for you to talk to, guys who are relevant for your area, who you can talk to, you can pick their brain, you can joke with them, laugh with them, tell them your story, whatever you want to do. It's going to be awesome time. We're already working on some past podcast guests, but hey, if you live in this area and you have a suggestion for someone you want to see at that show, write in and we'll see if we can get them. There's going to be all kinds of exhibitors at the show that are focused on hunting, fishing, conservation, and recreation. There's going to be activities for the whole family there. They got axe throwing, archery. They're going to have our podcast booth. And then for the kids, they got touch tanks, a honeybee exhibition, a raptor show, kids fishing tank, BB gun range, and a butterfly house. So you're going to love it. Your kids are going to love it. It's going to be an awesome time. So head on over to ecowildexpo.com to get more information on the show and to go ahead and grab your tickets. And hey, mark it on your calendar, May 10th through the 12th. Be there. We want to see you and we're excited to talk to you. So we'll see you at the EcoWild Expo this May 10th through the 12th at the Mobile Convention Center in Mobile, Alabama.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Southern Outdoorsman Podcast. Today, we are just getting back from the NWTF convention, and I'm exhausted. I'm so tired. Jacob, how are you doing?
Doing well. You got a hard workout on today, and now I'm kind of regretting it a little bit.
Might have overdone it, huh?
Come back with a little bit of a cold, and then you go work out, and I'm like, I need some more caffeine. But other than that, no, doing good. What do you think about NWTF this year?
It was, I'd like to know the number of people that came because it seems like they broke the attendance record.
Yeah.
I don't know if they did or not, but it was very, there was a lot of people.
Yeah, I'll say by far the busiest Thursday and busiest Friday I've ever seen. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think we've been going to the show, I think 6 years now, seven?
I think the first year I went was 2017.
Yeah.
I've been going every year since then. And man, it was pretty wild. There was a lot of people. We got to run into some listeners. We appreciate everyone who we got to run into. That was a good time. So Yeah, man. It was a fun show. If you didn't go, you missed out big time.
And if you didn't go, you probably didn't see this, but Vortex just released their new Defender ST Red Dot, which is a pretty sweet red dot. We actually got it a couple weeks ago, and they released it at NWTF, which was pretty cool to kind of see the response from it. Freaking absolutely bulletproof. Not actually bulletproof. Don't shoot the thing. It does have a VIP warranty, but, you know, don't shoot the thing. But I don't know if I'm going to say bombproof. Don't be in a place where you got bombs going off. But very tough red dot. So I'm really excited to run that sucker on our shotguns this spring, because we actually went out. When we get back from NWTF, we actually took the red dots out. Not these. We had took our red dots out. My shotgun with the red dot actually shot quail. And
yeah,
it was pretty fun. I'm not going to lie. So get that sucker mounted up and get ready to roll, because, dude, turkey season is coming upon us. Every time we get to NWTF, it's like right around that window of time, we're like, oh, man, you know, thinking some turkeys, you know, get some warm days happening. Mm. And all of a sudden you go and it's like switch is flipped.
Yeah, 100%.
Ready to roll.
Yeah, I was like, I was talking about the last day of deer season. Me and Tiffany went out and hunted that morning. Actually, me and Tiffany and Piper went out and hunted that morning. And we went out there, and it was like kind of warm right there at daylight, and the birds started chirping, you know, right at gray light. And I was like, oh, man, I kind of like sat up in my seat a little bit and was just listening, because I was like, oh, they might gobble this morning, because last day of season here is February 10th. So pretty late, you know. It's not uncommon to hear birds gobbling in February. I mean, you can definitely hear it. And I heard from a couple other people that morning that said that they heard birds gobbling. So I was like, I was kind of listening, didn't hear one, was kind of disappointed. But yeah, I've been getting excited for turkey season. But then, yeah, NWTF shows up and it just really flips that switch. Especially, I don't know what it is about it either. I think it's just all the stories that you get to talk about with people about, you know, turkey hunts I had last year, or just talking turkey with people, it kind of reignites that flame. And man, it was very interesting. Got to go with a lot of people and talk turkey, but also got to go to a seminar. It was pretty interesting. A research seminar by Dr. Craig Harper out of Tennessee. Yep. Where they were essentially studying,
University of Tennessee.
Yeah. University of Tennessee out there in Knoxville. And they studied the effects of a delayed turkey season on I'm gonna kind of butcher it, but just to sum up, basically nesting dates and nesting success. Okay, so we've had Dr. Chamberlain on the podcast, Dr. Michael Chamberlain, on a couple times, and we've done a good bit of talking about, you know, turkey seasons and I guess the decline in turkey populations. And one of the theories behind the decline in turkey populations is that we're killing too many turkeys too early. So basically, like the way that the pecking order works, or the hierarchy works with turkeys, you know, all the boys kind of duke it out, and then, you know, the dominant gobbler goes and breeds his hens. And basically the theory is, again, I might be oversimplifying a little bit, but you go out there and you kill that dominant gobbler, then they have to redo that pecking order. They don't just go out and start breeding hens, you know. Mm-hmm. So in theory, you're pushing back the nesting date. So if hens are supposed to nest on, man, I should have took the date. The arbitrary date. This might not be any realistic date, but like, let's say they're supposed to nest by like May 28th or something. But now, because of like some kind of interference, now they're not initiating that nest until June 15th. Mm-hmm. Well, then that puts them at a disadvantage, because you have like weather events, you have extreme heat. Those poults don't get to live as long, basically, in summer, like going into fall. They have a shorter amount of time between when they're hatched and when they go into fall. So there's like a lot of factors that decline their chances for survival, because they breed and they hatch at a certain time for a reason. Kind of like whitetails rut at a certain time because, like, especially in northern latitudes, they're wanting to drop those fawns at a certain time, so they have basically time to get big enough to survive winter. Because if they're too young and they go into a really harsh winter, say in like Michigan or Wisconsin or somewhere like that, a bunch of fawns are going to die. Mm-hmm. So they have to be born at like a certain time to take advantage of that weather opportunity. Same thing with turkeys, okay? So all that to preface that a bunch of states, based on past research, have started pushing back turkey seasons. Like, my whole life, it's been about March 15th that we started hunting here in Alabama. Now, if you're a public land guy, it's April 8th. I mean, they pushed it way back. They like seriously cut into, you know, like when it starts. Now it does end a little bit later as well. But that pushing back that start date, there was a lot of mixed feelings on it, and you know, a lot of people were upset about it. And basically, the study they did in Tennessee found that there wasn't really much of an effect by pushing the season back. So they had two counties that were non-delay counties. So they opened at the same time, and they had two counties that were delay counties. And they tracked them for a total of 6 years. They tried to track it for 8 years, but the state actually voted and changed the law to push turkey season back statewide. So the study kind of got cut short because those non-delay counties got delayed after 6 years of the study. But all that to say, and I'd love to have Dr. Harper on sometime to talk about this, all that to say that basically what he found was the annual variation in like nest initiation dates. So like what date are the hens initiating their nest, most of the hens initiating their nest, or what hen survival or whatever. So those statistics, there's an annual variation in them. You know, it's not like they have a calendar and they're like, May 25th, we're nesting, you know? So there's an annual variation. Essentially, what he was making the case of is through their study, they found that the delay didn't have an impact greater than the annual
variability.
So in other words, if the annual variability is like 4%, they couldn't find a change greater than 4%, meaning no impact. So that's one study. I'd love to have him on. It's an opposing viewpoint of like what we've talked about in the past. So it's pretty interesting. He also had some other statistics that he kind of threw in there at the end as like a kicker, where they surveyed 2,000 hunters, over 2,000 hunters in Tennessee, and they surveyed them about their success rates. They surveyed them about their satisfaction with the delayed seasons and whatnot. And that was actually very interesting. I took some rough notes like as he was going. Here's just like an interesting point that I missed. 50% of the hens nesting occurred on 7% of the landscape. So all like half of the nesting occurred on 7%, and that's just to demonstrate that there's like a lack of habitat, and that's probably the main driving factor behind everything, which you know most people would agree. Also, 12% of nests that were in fields were destroyed by mowing. So, you know, if you got a club or if you got land and you got turkeys and you got overgrown fields, maybe don't mow during nesting season. That's 12%. That's a lot. Okay, let's see. Hunter effort went down in delayed counties, but harvest was not impacted. So, meaning people didn't hunt as much, they didn't put as much effort in, but they killed the same amount of birds, which is interesting because when they pushed that season back to April 1st, again, talking public land here in Alabama, when they pushed it back to that first week of April, back when they opened it on March 15th, it was always kind of tough those first couple weeks because the birds were always like really henned up and, you know, they weren't quite doing the thing yet. And really around April 1st, that's when at least a lot of people I knew started killing birds. So now you had it to where no one can even start hunting them until April 1st. So the theory was, you know, they're not pressured. So when you get out there on that first hunt, they're not pressured and they're ready to play the game. And so, yeah, I felt like that, too, actually, with the delayed season that, like, you just had better success right off the bat. So, it increased hunter efficiency. Like, people weren't putting in enough time. Like, they weren't putting in as much time as before, but they were still killing the same amount. So, they were more efficient, but they still killed the same amount of birds. The average number of gobblers heard went down in the delayed counties and up in the normal counties. So, that was interesting. 62% of the hunters surveyed did not hunt in the last 2 weeks of season. That was interesting. Which I could see that for sure, man. That was something we were talking about with turkey hunting.
Yeah.
In general, like the further you get in the season, a lot of people start dropping off. It starts getting hot. The bugs come out, and they're just not, you know, not into it. You know, they went on their couple turkey hunts, and
they stop hearing gobbles for a couple hunts. They're like, well, it's not worth. I'm going to go fish now.
Yeah, and also, man, he had a good statistic. I missed it on taking the notes, but you would have loved this one. It was the statistics of what percentage of hunters killed a bird, what percentage of hunters killed two, what percentage of hunters killed three. Mm-hmm. And it's like exactly what you'd think it would be. 50-some-odd percent did not kill a bird, and then, you know, some odd percent killed one. And of course, the one, the guys who were tagging out was like a very small percentage.
Yeah, probably single percentile.
Yeah, it's like 9% or something like that. And then also, here's a very interesting one that I want like people to roll around in their head a little bit. They maintained a harvest of about 30,000 turkeys a year. So the state of Tennessee killing about 30,000 turkeys a year, even after the bag limit dropped from 4 to 2. So he had this placed on a graph, and you know, throughout the 80s and 90s or whatever, that number was just going up and up as turkey populations increased. It was going up and up and up, and then it kind of plateaued out around 30,000 birds a year, sometime in the 2000s. Mm-hmm. And basically, it's just kind of hovering. It's going up and, you know, going above and below 30, but averaging out to about 30,000 birds per year. That was when they had a 4-bird bag limit, and then they dropped it to 3, then they dropped it to 2, and it stayed right there. The only outlier year was 2020, when everyone was off for COVID, and then it spiked, you know, and they killed a bunch. But that was also interesting that they changed the bag limit. It was 4, it went to 2, and they killed about the same amount of turkeys. So that was interesting as well. There was a lot of other stuff in it that I wish I could have got better notes on. He was moving pretty quick, and I was like 2 or 3 minutes late to it because they put it in just the weirdest place, and it took me forever to find it in Opryland. Anyone who's been to Opryland knows how confusing that place is, and I know it pretty well, and it still took me a long time to find that room. So anyways, super interesting stuff. I'd love to get some comments, some feedback on what people think about that study. Do you agree with the delays? Do you disagree? Do you want to hear from Dr. Craig Harper on that? Hit us up. I want to hear it. Do you have any thoughts on it?
Interesting thing about it. So harvest rates never change. You know, still average out to roughly 30,000 birds a year based off his study, but the bag limit went down. And I've heard a lot of people talk about, especially in the turkey hunting industry, that like reducing bag limits is not saving turkeys.
Yes,
like it's not having effect because the general population isn't killing a turkey.
Yeah,
and then the amount of people that are killing turkeys, I wonder how that averages out per state. Like, I wonder what Alabama's like success rate is. So you said that's like roughly 56% of people in Tennessee that turkey hunted, or at least went on a turkey hunt, did not kill a turkey.
Yeah,
and it's like
it might have been 51%. It was something. It was in the 50s.
But still, and
half the people that go don't kill a turkey,
and it kind of goes. It's so fascinating. Now, also an interesting aspect. So, and it doesn't seem like they hit it on that study, but like, what's happening with the recruitment rate with poults? Mm-hmm. Like, are they seeing a decline in, like, even all these things are changing? Are they seeing an increased stability or decline in poults?
Yeah.
Being produced, and also how many eggs a hen's actually laying. And the variability there, which that'd be pretty hard because I've heard somebody, might have been Dr. Chamberlain actually talking about. It's kind of tough doing studies like and actually going out and seeing different nests because like when you introduce a foreign scent, just like a human going in there, it's something that also predators may kind of key in on and just like kind of check out. So like you're by going and checking a nest, especially if you checked it one time, multiple times, whatever, you're already hurting the viability potentially of those eggs actually, you know, producing.
Yeah.
So you know, that makes it kind of tough, but it's such a hot button topic, man. Like, you know, some people are like, man, we need to reduce bag limits. Other people are like, dude, bag limits don't do, it doesn't make a difference. But it all, to be honest, it seems like maybe it's not the issue everywhere, but at least in the Southeast, the biggest issue is habitat loss for that habitat that they're specifically wanting to nest in.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure. And actually, that's like, that's my opinion on it too. Like, again, I'd like to have these guys on and talk to them. I'm not a biologist, I'm not a researcher, but all I can do is take what these people are saying and process it and use my own logic, you know, and try to figure out what I think of it. And I guess what I think is, like, when it comes to the delayed season and everything, it seems like with that, we're like the tail's wagging the dog a little bit. You know what I'm saying? Like, could it be a problem? Like, maybe. But like, to me, it seems fairly obvious that the problem is habitat. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's got, and you know, Harper opened up his thing with the fact that it's habitat. Timber's managed different. Family farms are managed different. A lot of family farms are getting turned into subdivisions. So, I mean, there's less habitat for turkeys to exist on, mm-hmm. you know. So, I don't know. I would love to have the guys on to talk about it.
Yeah, you know, I think it'd be a very interesting conversation. You know, that's the thing. Again, kind of going back, and we mention them all the time, both Kyle and Alan, Kyle Liebarger and Alan Summerford, who's been on the podcast a whole bunch. Alan's with Land and Legacy, Kyle's with Native Habitat Project, and Alan actually kind of floats back and forth and works with both organizations. You know, talking about like having like really good quality early successional habitat, but mm-hmm. stuff that like both poults, like turkey poults, but also like quail can like navigate through it is yeah. like super critical. And that's like the implementation of fire, but also like managing your timber in a specific way where there's a fine line of maximizing timber revenue and declining and like hurting wildlife populations.
Yeah.
And then also like offering a benefit to the wildlife populations by maybe not having as thick a timber stands, mm-hmm. but then losing out potentially on some revenue because mm-hmm. you have less, it's not basal, is it basal area? Or I keep using the wrong term.
That's not really the right term.
Well, anyways, but just having less timber, like per acre, less logs, cuttable logs on.
I guess basal area could
be used for it, but yeah. But it's like a fine line you got to kind of navigate. And I think really, I'll be honest, where the pressure needs to be put on from all turkey hunters is these timber companies.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm
just like
at,
we
dude.
Mentioned on Monday's episode when we were talking about this deer study and like uh-huh. kind of putting the pressure back on these timber companies that hey, is there a way we can kind of work together where y'all can still manage timber, get your money on your timber, but we can manage it maybe slightly different, run some fires, maybe in some areas if it makes sense for them to do specific types of thinnings to be able to allow more sunlight to come down. And give us more cover, more food sources for the deer. Same thing for the turkeys.
Yeah.
I feel like this comes directly back to the hunters, again, voicing your opinion directly with these timber companies where, like, they mm-hmm. potentially – to me, if a couple timber companies – like, if you had Westervelt get on board, yeah. like, hey, we're going to start doing stuff a little bit different, try to help out with wildlife population while we're still managing for timber,
yeah.
that could make a massive impact. Because yeah. there's such large property owners in the Southeast.
That's what I'm getting at, too. Because it's like, yeah, we can look at the delayed season thing. But it's like, okay, even if the delayed season... And also, by the way, Harper, in his thing, he did show the graph of their recruitment rates. I think the metric he used was hen survival. Mm-hmm. And in 5 of the 6 years he had graft, it was lower than the replacement rate. So meaning they weren't making enough hens to replace themselves.
Yep.
So less than one hen was like the replacement rate for 5 of those 6 years, yep. which is like really bad. I mean, that's a declining population mm-hmm. in those counties. He also noted that doesn't mean that it's statewide, mm-hmm. Because there are plenty of people who say they don't feel like populations are dropping at mm-hmm. all.
Yeah.
And so that's good, but it's obviously going to be like a localized thing. But all that to say that if pushing the seasons back, it doesn't seem like it has like the effect we want it to. It seems like everyone should kind of focus their fire on the habitat issue.
Well, I think the whole pushing seasons back is one of those things that like states feel like mm-hmm. they're not going to get in trouble by doing so because they can blame hunters on blame hunters on the issues that are being had.
Yeah.
But it based off like Craig Harper's findings. And I'm sure there's maybe some other studies ongoing right now that we don't know about because nothing's been published yet.
Yeah.
Potentially can show it's not really the hunters aspect. Like the hunters aren't necessarily the ones hurting the population, but it's more about land use practices
yeah.
and what's being done there. And again, if you want to do large scale land management, public land's not the place to do it unless you're like in Montana, one of these Western states where like, it might be 50% or 60% of the state's public land, or especially yeah. like the Southwest states, which is, it might be even higher than that compared to like the Southeast, specifically the Southeast where probably most of our listeners and viewers and everybody's coming in from. I know some of you guys in the other parts of the country that listen and watch the show, but the biggest landowners down here are timber companies,
yep.
especially when you get in the deep South, it's timber companies. And those timber companies, could do a lot if you had the right people, some of those organizations that kind of saw the benefit from a wildlife value standpoint of like just what that brings into communities and areas, along with how they can maximize their timber harvest rates, but still be able to give back when it comes to like the wildlife management. That's where you're going to move the needle so much faster and efficiently than even just small landowners that have 100, 200 acres trying to do stuff. So I feel like the more that could be done where these different organizations like Turkeys for Tomorrow, I'm sure these organizations are kind of trying to build relationships there, but like Turkeys for Tomorrow, NWTF, and other organizations, having relationships and working relationships with some of these large timber companies and try to help move the needle, and the same thing getting state on board of like, hey, what could we do, guys? Is there a way we can kind of, you know, how can we start running some more fires? How can we work on, you know, thinning some more?
How can we incentivize that?
Absolutely.
From a policy standpoint, how can we incentivize the timber companies to do that kind of stuff?
Absolutely.
Yeah, because we can't just come to them and be like, out of the goodness of your heart and for the good of turkeys, will you please make less money?
Absolutely.
So there has to be some kind of incentive there. And also, by the way, one way I've heard it put too is, you know, like I wouldn't necessarily say they're like trying to quote unquote blame the hunters, but I think it's more of the state agencies. Like, this is how I've heard it put to me before. Yeah. They can't control what a timber company does. The only thing they can control is the regulations.
Absolutely.
So they're trying to control the regulations. I understand like the thought behind that, but also on the delayed seasons thing, for instance, if let's say 10 years down the road, there's a bunch more studies and we know for sure that it does not work, are they going to put the seasons back where they were?
No, absolutely.
Probably
not. Absolutely not.
Probably not. So, you know, once it gets taken away, then it's probably gone.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's why I'm like, hey, guys, let's maybe pump the brakes here a little bit on this stuff. Because I've heard people arguing for an even later start. Like, Alabama opened April 15th.
Yeah.
Which would be complete insanity, in my opinion. Like, that's just so – that's so late, you know? Like, the March 25th on private land, like, that's probably a pretty good date. You know, I'd be fine, you know, keeping that date for sure. But, like, they keep pushing it back. Like, on public now, you can't hunt till April 8th.
In a couple of units, there's one.
It's even later.
It's like April 14th.
I think that I think that's terrible. I don't like that at all. And you know, I'm sure that there's a lot of people out there that disagree with me, but that's okay. We can disagree. Mm-hmm. And we still be friends.
Absolutely.
You know? But I just, man, that's just so late, especially for the public land guy. Like, it just sucks for the public land dude. Like, I'm, you know, lucky enough to have this club right here, but for years I didn't have that. And you know, when they started implementing that and pushing back all these season dates, it was like, man, like, this sucks. Mm-hmm. Like, if you think this delay works, why are you only doing it on public? Why don't you do it on private too, you know?
It's the testing group.
Yeah, they're using the public. Again, it's what they can control. That's the argument that they make. That's what they can control, for, you know, and study and whatnot. But, you know, I'd like to see the paper that came from it.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, it's super interesting. But, I mean, I think there's needs, like, just like we mentioned on Monday's episode, end of Monday's episode, trying to build a relationship like for individual hunting clubs with whoever their timber company they're leasing that property from, like hunting rights from, building a relationship there and getting some feedback whether or not, you know, you can try to work with the timber company, start running fires, figuring out what other kind of management strategy they have from a timber harvest standpoint, and just kind of running with that. And you actually got some feedback. Didn't you get NWTF from somebody with Westervale or something like that? Or did you figure something out?
Yeah, somebody told me about some people at Westervale I could possibly contact. And also, I was talking to our buddy Cody, who we quail hunted with the other day. And he's in the club across the street as well as our club. And again, it's all Westervale. And I mentioned it to him, and he said that their club president might have gotten permission to burn, but they haven't done it yet. So I want to talk to that guy and see what the deal is there, because I mean, they're a big chunk, you know, they're almost twice as big as our club. Mm-hmm. So if they can burn, then we can for sure burn. I don't know if the guys in my club would be willing to do that, but it's the same land manager, it's the same timber company, and same the guy who oversees the property is the same guy. So that would mean that we can, and I think the other two clubs that are close to us could too. So that's exactly what we were talking about. If we get that big co-op going, basically, where all these clubs all agree to, you know, start burning, doing this stuff, and we were talking to Cody the other day, kind of getting back onto the deer stuff, there's been a lot of timber cut on all these clubs around here, And, you know, we have that big 10 point on camera. By the way, I'm staying in the club, everybody. We got some questions and comments about it. And I was on the board. I was on the fence about it. And then at the NWTF convention, which we talked about him earlier, Alan Summerford was like, hey, man, Alan's like the nicest guy ever. Love the dude. Total stud. Total stud. I love the guy. He's like, man, you know, I was thinking, like, you really should probably stay in that club. And he was like, very nicely told me, he's like, bro, stay in the club. And I was like, if Alan Summerford tells me to stay in the club, I'm staying in the club.
Yeah, what Alan wanted to say about it, he's too nice to say, is you're an idiot if you get out of that club. You got 2 years of history with it. What are you doing? Why are you going to start over again?
Yeah, and yeah, people, again, need to go back and listen to Alan's episodes, because he kills, out of just sheer, like, large bucks in Alabama. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know if anyone can touch what he does. I mean, out of the 560 episodes we've done, 559, whatever it is now, out of all the people we talk to in Alabama, as far as consistency goes, like, mm-hmm. man, that guy is, he gets it done.
Rock
I was
star.
Telling him that at the NWTF convention. So when he talks, I listen.
Yep.
So yeah, I'm for sure staying in it. But
yeah, so what was funny, he told me that first, mm-hmm. and I'm like, I 100% agree, because he was like, dude, y'all travel too much.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's like, as much as y'all bounce around, I don't think I could ever kill a big deer bouncing around as much as you guys do.
Yeah, that's what he was saying. He's like, I don't think I could do it, man.
He's like, man, you need to learn one or two properties, get your dates all lined up, which we're going to talk about on a future episode.
Yes.
Get your dates lined up, know when your dates are, and he's like, if the dates don't line up, don't worry about it. Mm-hmm. Go do something else.
Yeah.
You know, go. Maybe you can go mill around another place. But, like, once you have those dates lined up and you be on that property in those specific spots that you scouted out, that, you know when bucks are coming through during specific daytimes, and you hunt during that window.
Yep.
And you kind of maybe move to something else. But, like, you have specific date ranges of when you hunt. And he's like, if you don't figure that out, you're always going to be trying to, like, you know, shoot yourself in the foot, trying to always figure out the next thing, but you're never, like, compounding on what
definitely.
You could be learning.
Definitely. Well, and so we just had that conversation with him, and then we come back here and we start talking to Cody, and we talk about the 10-point a lot, you know, now that season's over, and we're discussing, like, where we've seen him and everything, what the other guys in the club were saying, and you asked him something about on the other club across the street, like, what's a big deer for them, and he was saying, you know, 125, 130, but there's a lot of new cutovers in this area, and this is something we've discussed a little bit in the past. So they just cut some stuff on my club. They just cut some stuff on the club across the street. They cut a lot on one of the other clubs, across the street.
And Cody's property.
Yeah, and Cody's property they cut. So,
and he, dude, we might have to have him on just to talk about, like, his management strategy for that place, because Kyle and I told him, I'm like, I need to introduce you to these guys, because I'm like, do you know them? Like, no, I don't know anything. What he's doing is going to be unbelievable in that mm-hmm. property.
Oh, yeah.
Un-freaking believable. When he, like, his 5-year plan is kill 150 inch deer on that property.
Mm-hmm.
And the area is definitely has the potential, just the lack of food and just not a ton of deer, but just really lack of food and good quality cover.
Yeah.
More food than anything. And what he's doing on that property is going to be un-freaking believable.
When you think turkey calls, think of Houndstooth. Houndstooth Game Calls is a company based right here in Alabama, actually based out of Tuscaloosa, and they have been making some of our favorite turkey calls since 2012. Y'all head on over to their website, see what they got. They got a little something for everybody. They have a huge selection of different mouth calls, different cuts, different reed configurations. I like to go on there and get 5 or 6 different mouth calls and just run them, see which ones I like the most. You know, some days I might like the KB Hen, some days I might like the Ghost Cut. Some situations I might like the Country Girl call, you know, that I can cut on really hard, where on other situations I might like the All Pro that I can get a little bit softer on. Bottom line, there's something for everybody and something for every situation. And hey, you can get 15% off of your order at Houndstooth Game Calls by using the promo code SOP24. That's SOP24. Use that promo code. It'll get you a discount and it helps out the podcast.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Man, Mark's Outdoors is your one-stop shop for everything outdoor and shooting related. They're a family-owned business that's been around for over 40 years now, been serving the Birmingham area, but now they have opened their doors to everyone across the United States through their online store. Again, me and Andrew have been using Mark's Outdoors for years now. They have unbelievable supplies of literally anything that we need, we can pick up from Mark's Outdoors. They're even carrying different saddle companies, sticks, platforms, the whole nine yards at Mark's Outdoors. And again, if you don't live in Alabama and you don't want to make the drive to Birmingham, you can go over to their website, marksoutdoors.com, and actually shop on their online store to get awesome deals on different products that you may be needing right now and be able to get to you in a very timely manner as well. So give Mark's Outdoors a try. We promise you, you'll enjoy them. They have unbelievable customer service and some of the best guys in the industry. TruLock Chokes has been made in Georgia since 1981 and offering a wide range of chokes, over 2,000 different chokes for all kinds of shooting activities. You might be wondering why you'd want to purchase a TruLock choke, and it's to improve your shotgun performance. Absolutely guaranteed. And as a great example, we have Andrew Maxwell here. And Andrew, you've had some pretty good luck, again, kind of switching out chokes and trying out the Precision Hunter choke from TruLock. So, Andrew, what's been your experience so far?
Yeah, I've used the same choke for several years now. I never really thought much of it, and I got the TruLock choke in. I patterned my gun with the first choke at 30 and 50, and then I switched to the TruLock and changed from 30 to 50. And the 50-yard pattern on my gun with the TruLock choke is unbelievable. Like, everybody's jaws were dropping. Like, when we were out there with Mike and Sam, we were all super impressed. I mean, it's throwing a better pattern at 50 now than it was throwing at 40 before my old choke.
And Andrew, you're shooting the Precision Hunter choke from TruLock. It's a great option. Same chokes I have in my shotgun. So guys, if you want to give TruLock a shot this spring, you can head over to TruLockChokes.com. That's TruLockChokes.com. You can also use the promo code Southern at checkout at TruLockChokes.com and save 10% on your order. Again, give TruLock a shot this spring, especially if you're not happy with the performance of your shotgun, and shoot with a more deadly pattern with TruLock.
Well, it plays right into this past Monday's episode with the MSU study that we went over this past Monday on the genetics versus nutrition, and all that stuff that they're cutting, all those trees that they're cutting, open up the canopy, they're thinning pines, they're doing full clear cuts. That's going to produce so much more food that, and we had so many like young kind of up and comer bucks on the property this year, and I know Cody had a bunch as well, that they're all going to get that shot of good browse and like a lot of food and all these new cuts. So it should be a good stretch of years, you know. It, like we were talking, he was mentioning that 5-year plan to kill a 150. Like I think he could for sure do it in 5 years, you know, especially with everything going on just again in the neighborhood.
Well, and I told him, I'm like, there's people 7 miles north of you, 8-10 miles north of you that kill 170s.
Yeah, 100%.
And it's like, why can't you 7-8 miles away, why can't you do it on your property?
Yeah, definitely.
I'm like,
great
point. I'm like, the area can do it. It's just having the right food. And I mean, just to be able to like relieve the stress from the deer, like just like that study talked about. Like, if a deer lives in a less stressful environment from food and social stresses, which just means too many deer and too many mouths on the landscape, and they have ample amount of food throughout the whole year, they can do some special things 5-10 years.
Yeah, definitely. And like I asked Cody about the doe population, because that's the other piece of the puzzle is, okay, do you have ample food, but do you have too many mouths to feed, you know? And he said, no, I think we're good. And I agreed with that for sure, because that's what I was thinking kind of coming out of this deer season, because it's not like you see a doe every single time you go hunt. If you see does like every single time you go and you see a bunch of does, you probably had too many does. At least that's what I've been told. And the bucks that we killed out there, both my buck and Mike's buck, had a bunch of fat on them, especially my deer, dude. Yep. I mean, he had like an inch of fat on his hindquarters. I don't think I've ever killed a deer that fat outside of Wyoming. Like, those bucks we killed in Wyoming were, like, very, very fatty. But over here...
Those bucks?
Yeah.
Which bucks?
The white tail and the mule deer.
Well, the mule deer don't really count. Don't worry about the mule deer.
Well...
I'll say that white tail trip, you're the only one to kill. Remember that.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm still salty.
That's right! But who's keeping track? But no, I think it's going to be a really good couple years, man. I'm excited. I'm excited about the future, these next couple seasons coming up. How it goes. I'm excited to see who all makes it through this year. We did have one buck. I don't know exactly which one it was, but I might have had it on camera that got run over. Wasn't the 10 point, but it was another younger deer. that Cody found. So that one's dead. That's like my greatest fear at this point. I'm like, please don't get run over by a car.
Yep.
Because he crosses the highway a good bit. So I'm like, please don't get run over.
Well, like, and also what Cody's doing, so he's got two different parcels that he owns. And the parcel that used to be like this little, I guess, cotton field or bean field, whatever, that he bought, he's got timber on it.
Yep.
The what he's trying to do out there and kind of get it back to, not really a CRP, like he's not rotating anything, but like just get it back to native grasses and everything.
Yeah.
And then also planting some plum thickets going across it. So you have like these travel corridors that you're like, you're able to manipulate and put it exact where you want it, where you have like good stand sites where you can like shoot that, whether it's bow hunting or gun hunting, but also gives like cover that deer can like kind of, you know, like a habitat edge those deer can kind of follow going from point A to point B across your property.
Yep.
I'm like, that's what Anthony's trying to do at the farm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's already some plums out there and little plum thickets, but, like, you know, trying to do it a little more widespread. And, but he's got a clean slate because part of that property is a big field. And he's like, I'm just going to let it go fallow. I'm going to manage it, going to burn it, get some more native species back, because he's like, they pretty much killed the seed bed because it's been farmed for so long. And he's like, everything coming up right now in the field is all non-native.
Yeah.
So he's like, it's going to be hard. Can I get that, you know, that seed bank built back up? And probably going to take a really long process, but, you know, putting them plum thickets in and everything else. I'm like, dude, this place is going to be crazy. Putting in a duck hole.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And everything. He's like, oh, yeah, I'm going to put a crop. Oh, yeah, I think it was when you left. He's like, yeah, I'm thinking about building one next to the road right there, a pond next to the road, and he's going to put one further back. But he's like, the one close to the road, I'm going to screen the whole road right there so you can't, like, see into the pond or anything or into the field.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, that might be a crappie pond. I like the way you think.
Ooh.
Leave the bass alone and still crappie pond.
Yeah, grow some trophy crappie.
As the crappie guy said, you don't want none of those trash fish. Largemouth trash fish.
Dang straight, son. All right, let's hit some Q&As.
Awesome.
Let's get on them. We're going to hit some deer Q&As. We still got a whole bunch of them
that we got to get through. So appreciate everybody that's been submitting Q&As. Again, there's a link down in the show notes and the show description on the podcast where you can actually submit your Q&As that we'll be answering these Thursday episodes. Especially as we're getting into the springtime, we're going to be doing a lot more turkey content. First turkey episode comes out actually next Monday, guys. And we just lined up our next one, which is going to be really good. So, but anyway, if you would, especially going into the spring, if you want to do like some postseason, you know, questions, postseason deer questions, but especially if you have a lot of turkey Q&A questions, get those written in and we're going to start answering those throughout this whole springtime. So we're really excited to kind of answer some of those turkey questions as they start coming. But on this episode, we'll kind of get to some of these deer questions that we still have, or actually we start with turkey.
No, we got some deer questions. Okay, we'll perfect. Do. All right. This is from Tracy Brooks, Alabama.
Killer. He's been on the podcast before. Young guy,
killer.
Got it.
When do bucks typically break out of bachelor groups, as in how many weeks before the peak rut? I had two nice bucks come by me this morning running together December 12th. The peak rut here is January 8th through 15th. So I'll take this one first. I've been a little bit curious about this myself because it's not actually something I've considered that much in the past until this year. I think we opened November 18th was the opening day of gun season, or 19th. It was the third Saturday in November, and I went out and had that encounter with the bachelor group. I had like four or five bucks come out and ended up killing that big 6-point that was in the group. And I was actually really surprised to see him bachelored up because, you know, it's like November. We were just in Arkansas hunting like rutting deer. And so, like, it just kind of caught me off guard, you know. And I think they were still running together for a couple weeks after that. Mm-hmm. Like we were seeing bucks in pairs, a pretty good bit. So I don't know, man. It's hard for me to say. I'd say probably like a month before, roughly a month before they might start breaking up. But it depends on your area.
I think it also depends on your age structure. Like I've seen during the rut, two young bucks together.
Actually, you know, yeah, I see that.
Two and a half year old bucks. Like that's I see that all the time. I think it's partly because, like, even though their testosterone is kind of going up, they're not really fighting it out, and they're just trying to figure out what's going on for the most part.
Yeah.
I think your older age class bucks are the ones to first peel off. Like, again, you look back at when you shot the 6-point, 10-point might have been with him. Okay.
Well,
but he wasn't necessarily right there with that group that, like, you know, as close as
and just
the
to preface
ones.
If people missed that episode, that the big 10-point on the club was running with the same, with this bachelor group. They came out and I watched him for about 15 minutes waiting for the 10 point, and it got to be the end of the legal light, so I shot the big 6 point.
But he kind of disappeared for a while, and I think he was probably the oldest buck in the group, and he just kind of split off. So I think it really happens. It'd be fun. It'd be interesting to kind of, you know, ask some other guys who have a lot more experience running trail cameras and really trying to figure out when this kind of happens in different areas, because especially in Alabama and a lot of the deep south, the rut's so all over the place. It's like when they might break up here where we're at, or like on some of our public that we hunt at, they rut in December. Mm-hmm. It can be completely different from other parts of Alabama where they might not be rutting to the last week of January or mid-January. Yeah. So, you know, that's such an interesting question, but I definitely think you ought to start seeing stuff. The second you start seeing sign being laid down, like a lot of sign, a lot of scrapes, a lot of rubs, you're probably having some bucks really start to split off. And I think your older age class bucks are breaking off those bachelor groups a lot sooner than your 2 and 3 year old deer.
Yeah, I for sure agree with that. And also, I don't know if this is, I'm curious if other people have seen this as well, where it seems like the bigger, older bucks that I've ever gotten on camera just over the years, aren't always with a bachelor group. Like even in that early summer or late summer time frame where you're kind of starting to run cameras in like August or September, I usually don't see him, because like the 10 point was a big buck, but I've showed him to several people now, and everyone thinks he's 4.5 this year. So he's not that old. I mean, he's just now kind of getting into his prime, and a lot of people would say he's not in his prime yet. You know, 5 or 6 would be his prime. So he was with a group, but some of the bigger, again, older bucks, like velvet bucks I've had on camera just on WMAs or like wherever I've been hunting, they've always been alone. You know, like the ones that that are probably like that much older age class, they've always been by themselves.
See, people say that, like, because I've heard a lot of other guys say, like, yeah, 5, 6-plus-year-old deer, there's a good chance he may be by himself or maybe just with another buck. One thing you don't realize, and I don't think they're ever with when they get to that age, like a huge group of deer. I'm sure someone probably has a confirmed 5.5, 6.5 year old buck with a bunch of other bucks, you know, in August, hanging out, off, not on a corn pile, but like off a food source that's on a transition area and travel corridor. But the thing is, your camera's watching a very specific view. Okay.
Yeah.
Like there was a time, I don't know if you saw today, we had one of our cell cameras go off and still on a scrape. Mm-hmm. And there's a doe or like a, it might have been spike working the scrape. And if you didn't really pay attention, there's another deer standing way up on the ridge behind it.
Yeah.
And then a couple minutes later, the other deer comes in. He's a little 8 point. Mm-hmm. But it's like, how often could you have a deer walk just behind the camera that's in a bachelor group and you just see one of them? You're like, oh man, he's all by himself. But I mean, my thing is, unless you got transmitter collars on a whole bachelor group, or on a whole bunch of bucks, you don't really know whether or not they're running by themselves. But I think probably at an older age class, we've had other podcast guests on the show talk about, it does seem like they're a little bit more loners at that point.
Yeah.
But I think it has to depend on your area, because I've talked to guys like, I think Michael Perry's talked about this a little bit, catching bucks in the summer on camera, and it seems like a lot of those older bucks are like in pairs.
Yep.
Or maybe by themselves. But it's like, again, you never really know unless you're like, you have your camera in a spot, and if they come through that spot, there is no other way to get past that camera.
I'd be really curious to hear other people's experiences on that. Like, write it in the comments, email it to us, you know, whatever the case may be. Like, I'd love to hear other opinions on that. So,
ooh,
what?
By the way, one segment I want to start doing on the podcast is reading a couple YouTube reviews.
Oh,
or YouTube comments.
Yeah, we need to start doing that. All right. Next up, this is from Dustin Higgins from Mississippi. He said, I hunt central Mississippi, and I killed a nice 8 point on November 25th. I decided to hunt a hardwood ridge that starts in select cut pines. I sat on the ground and rattled very lightly for about 10 to 15 seconds. About 5 minutes later, I had a 3.5-year-old buck and a mature buck almost run over me. They stopped in the hardwood bottom beside me where I made the shot. Is this indicating that they're in rut or just asserting dominance? I say that because I'm only seeing spikes messing with does lately. No heavy chasing that I've observed. So it sounds like maybe like kind of that early rut time frame. Like, I don't necessarily think that would be like an indication that they're in the rut, but maybe like pre-rut. I mean, I would say, because it seems like that rattling and grunting is most effective like right before it kind of breaks over into the rut. And the fact that you're seeing little bucks like spikes messing with does, it confirms that even more for me, because those little bucks, like, they don't know what they're doing, and they start harassing the does, you know, way before they come into heat. So, like, that's how I've always actually looked for, like, signs of the rut, like signs of what's to come. If I see small, like, 1.5, 2-year-old bucks, like, cruising around and harassing does, and if, you know, I'm hearing vocalizations or fighting or whatever, like, those are finding where bucks are fighting, you know, like in a dirt road where it's all kicked out and everything's destroyed. You found that this year, especially. Mm-hmm. You found a crazy buck fight, like where 2 bucks had fought. But what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think it's early. I mean, the podcast guests who we always kind of go back to when it comes to calling, just because we've had so many listener success stories come from it. I think it's episode like 290, Calling the Right Way with Richard Fott. Richard Fott's been on the podcast a whole bunch in the past. He's from Arkansas, and he always talks about having – he always would talk about having a lot of success calling really – I mean, even early bow season, but specifically that pre-rut, I mean, super early rut stage where there's not very many does, if any does, really coming to heat. And then also kind of late rut, post-rut time period where, like, you catch that curiosity of that buck and it's not rattling hard. He rattles really, really light all season long. He's never smashed antlers. But it's more curiosity, like 2 bucks sparring, which could be a couple things. It could be 2 bucks kind of messing around, just kind of, you know, two and a half year old, 3.5 year old bucks just kind of joking around a little bit. Or it could be the beginning stage of a buck getting ready to go all out war with another buck. But again, I think just based off what you're saying, it's just early where you're at. But the thing is, remember that. You need to remember that date, November 25th, and you need to be back in that same area next year doing the exact same thing again.
Yes, okay? 100%. Mark it on your calendar right now.
Because I've got a spot, and after talking to some past podcast guests and also future podcast guests we're going to have on this summer talking about this, when you have success doing that, whether it's calling in deer or seeing like mature bucks during a certain window of time in a specific spot, you need to remember that and be back in there in those same areas doing the same thing again. Because I called in my second buck I killed in Alabama this year, grunted him in 10 yards, shot him next day, did the exact same thing, called in another buck down the same trail out of the same tree. He stopped just inside the thick pines. I couldn't get a shot at him. I could see his brisket. I could see his neck. Could see his legs. Could not see his head. Don't know how big he is. Acted like a mature buck. Don't really know.
Booner.
I mean, you see his neckline come all the way down to his brisket. Probably a big deer. Don't really know him. Wasn't going to ground check him because of antler point restrictions. But I know that date range specifically, I will be back in that tree doing the exact same thing in that spot and just seeing, because for whatever reason, it seems like those bucks are coming through those areas and they're looking for something of that sort. Something that's catching their eye, catching their ear, that is telling them that, hey, something's going on, whether it's early doe comes into heat, bucks are getting a little bit more aggressive, they're laying down a little bit more sign, they're checking some of these different bedding areas a little bit more before it really kicks off, because those mature bucks are trying to find the first hot doe coming into heat. Mm-hmm. Now, they're 5, 6 years old. They've been doing this for a few years. They know where those deer are coming into heat typically every single year, those first few does. So if you can find that pocket of activity, make sure you capitalize on every year.
Yep. Love it. All right. Last up, Matt B. from Alabama. New hunter question. I have around 40 acres to hunt all private, basically all hardwoods, with about 2 acres worth of old ag land that is still kept mowed. 1 to 3 people hunting this property. It's about 1.5 miles from the edge of a national forest. Between is pretty much all timber property. The property right behind me is leased to a hunting club. Onyx shows besides the clubs that surrounding me, my neighbors have green fields planted. I have 3 cameras out and have had them out for about 2.5 years. I repeatedly see a nice 8-point and many does. I understand to hunt the transition from my hardwood and pines on the property lines. My question is, what can I do to make the property more attractive to deer? I've got a 250-pound feeder, planted the old ag field with some plot seed, and have 1 mock scrape set up. I'm thinking about making a cistern or some kind of water catchment since there's no water I can spot immediately near me. Anything else? Also, great podcast. I've learned and was able to take a doe in mid-November thanks to the info exactly like you guys put out. If y'all want to slap some knowledge on a mid-30s dude that's getting into his getting into this to counter some issues from the military, I'd be grateful. Sorry, I can't read. That was super bad. Also, it'd be awesome to learn what I'm looking for on public land, being this close to a certain public land place that I will not read off on this podcast. I would totally meet y'all to do some scouting. Public land is my next adventure, using this property to kind of figure things out. Again, thanks for what y'all do. All right,
clarifying. He says he's got 1 to 3 other people that hunt it?
Yes.
All right, dude, if you got 40 acres and there's 1 to 3 other people hunting and you don't know when and how they're coming in there, that is some high pressure. I guarantee the public next to your property you have access to might be way better. You can't run corn out there. Yeah. I understand. You can't plant food plots. I understand.
Yeah.
But you're going to find a lot less pressure and you'll be able to hunt a lot more of those transition areas and probably have a lot more success and actually see more deer because you're going to be able – not necessarily even worry about getting away from people, but there's just going to be less people on a big piece of public land like that compared to a 40-acre chunk that has – I don't know how you have an understanding of 1 to 3 people, but if there's, you know, upwards, say, if it's just you and another guy, 2 to, on the upper end, 4 people hunting 40 acres, that is a ton of pressure. You can have all the corn and everything. With the guys that we've had on the podcast that's had the most success hunting small properties, number one, they don't hunt it very much. They do like what Alan Summerford has talked about, and I'll find his podcast number real quick. This would be a really good one for you to go back and listen to, where he's hunted this property for quite a while, you know, 8, 10 years, 15 years now, and he knows, based on running trail cameras, he's got a food plot on the property, thickets and everything, he's kind of made on the property for bedding, but he uses it as a sanctuary except for about a 5-day window of period of time. A whole season. So he's not hunting that property other than about 5 to 6 days, like that window of time, and that's when he hunts. And when typically he does it, he either sees the biggest buck on the property and can shoot it or not, just depending on whether or not it's not, you know, it's what he's looking for, or he's going to have some sort of an opportunity, okay?
Yeah.
And I think that's the biggest thing for hunting small properties, because I did this. I had a permission on a small property that I hunted. We hunted the absolute crap out. I'm talking about there was not a more high-pressure piece of private land in the state of Alabama, I guarantee, okay? Those deer knew what trees we wanted to get into, knew how we were coming in every single time. And funny enough, my brother still killed a pretty nice buck on the place. But that was late post rut, the whole 9 yards, and you know, finally caught a buck coming through there. But the situation is, if it's you and other guys on the property, it's going to be very hard for you guys to kind of work together more than likely, unless you're all on the same page, of only hunting it during a very specific window of time based off daylight activity on cameras and when bucks are actually using that property. Because a buck's not going to stay on 40 acres. A doe's not going to stay on 40 acres. So it's going to be very difficult, especially if you can't do any kind of actual habitat work, cutting some trees down, building some cover, having some more food, not outside of your bait pile, your corn feeder, you know, food plot, stuff like that. It's going to be tough. So my recommendation, and Andrew, I'll get you your take on it, is I'd just start exploring some of that public land, leave the feeder at the house. You can't run corn on public, and just go out there and literally go with the mindset. Even if you're not going to hunt it next year, you know, this 2024, 2025 season, go get you a couple cameras, go put them out there and some sign, focus specifically on big scrapes, just kind of get some inventory, and just at least do that if you're not going to actually hunt the place. And have an idea of when and how bucks are coming through those areas. And then maybe the following year, you decide, okay, I'm going to go try this public out.
I agree with everything you just said. The water thing would be kind of intriguing if, again, there wasn't the other hunter pressure on the property. Because the thing about the other hunter pressure on the property is, like, that makes... For me, at least, that would kind of kill my motivation to do anything like of substance out there. Like, if I was gonna try to work, I don't know who owns the land, but like try to work with the landowner to maybe like get some bedding cover on it. Because if you say it's mostly hardwoods and then an ag field that they mow, sounds like you don't have a lot of cover. So like, if I could control the property, I'd want to maybe add some cover, maybe put some water in. Like, that could definitely be helpful. But yeah, I mean, just the fact that there's other people hunting it like that. And also, you say you got a 8-point coming in repeatedly on camera. I would be interested in hunting the property like whenever he's daylighting. We keep talking about annual patterns on this podcast. So like, if the week of like November 20th, that buck just starts showing up in daylight and no one killed him, then, or even if someone did kill him, that same week every year, that's the week I'd be interested in hunting it. Mm-hmm. But to make the most of the property, like you said, Jacob, I would learn the other hunters, like how are they walking into the property? What trees are they hunting? How are the deer possibly avoiding them? And take that approach to it and be, instead of making it like, oh, this is your property and this is where you hunt, make it more surgical, like where you're like, these are the days where I go out there and I hunt it on very specific days in a very specific way. And then other than that, go hunt the public, kind of like we were talking about earlier. You know, you don't want to bounce around too much, but at the same time, a lot of guys with small properties like that kind of work themselves into a corner because they got an 8-point on camera and the other three guys, you know about the same deer. And so they're like, well, I got to go this Saturday. Otherwise one of those guys is going to kill it. Or I just got to put my time in and hunt it. And you're kind of making the property worse when you do that, especially when you're habitual and you do the same thing over and over and over again. So I would take a more like strategic approach to hunting the property and just take what you've learned with your cameras. I'm assuming if it's 40 acres, you've probably walked the whole thing by now. I mean, if you haven't, for sure walk the whole thing, find out where the scrapes are, if you got any scrapes on the property, and find those two or three good spots. Like on 40 acres, you might have two or three like good spots. You might only have one good spot.
Yeah.
And figure out where that is. And if nobody else is hunting it, don't put a ladder stand up. Don't put a ground blind up. Don't put flagging tape up. Don't put a feeder up. Don't even put a trail camera up unless you're going to hang it way up in a tree, because I wouldn't want any of the other guys, again, assuming that you're not working with them and it's like kind of competitive, I wouldn't want any of the other guys to know exactly where that spot's at. And that's actually one thing I was talking to Cody about the one sticking thing, is I really like one sticking. And this is something I didn't even think about till I started doing it, because there is absolutely no trace that I ever hunted that tree. There's very small little scratches where the stick bites in, but it's not like a climber where you're chewing that tree up all the way and anyone can see like where you climb that tree.
Yeah.
Because I don't want, like I've made the case at the club, there's some guys in the club who are hunting all over where that 10 point is, but they're hunting like not far at all from where they probably could kill him, but they're accessing it wrong and they're facing the wrong direction in most of their setups. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to go skin up a pine tree, climbing it two or three times in the kill spot where that guy can go walking through there and see that and be like, oh, this is where he's hunting, you know? And then, you know, start hunting my spot. Not my spot. I don't own the spot, but, you know, I'm just trying to be secretive about the stuff that I've worked hard to figure out.
Yeah.
So, what's your take on that?
Instead of having the tree skinned up, looking like, you know, you had a climber up and down, it looks like a Black Panther came through and just sharpened his claws on the tree.
Oh, wildcat came climbing up that thing.
By the way, so the episode you need to go back and listen to is episode 476. It came out last May, and that was with Alan Summerford. The title is Chasing Southern Giants with Alan Summerford. So in that episode, again, 476, episode 476, he goes in detail about the success he's had both on large properties and small properties and how he hunts them differently. And I think anybody out there that's hunting a small property, and I say a small property, like less than 75 acres, probably. I mean, almost maybe less than 100 of what you should do, because I kind of told Anthony a little bit about this episode too, and he likes Alan because Alan came down to the property and walked the property. It's like, if you can have another area to go hunt where there's a hunting club, a piece of public land, something else, and you just kind of save that property until like the timing when you have a little annual history on the property with like certain time frames, date ranges that bucks are daylighting, but also kind of watching cameras and seeing when activity really starts spiking during daylight, and then go in there strategically hunt, you're going to have a lot more success killing a lot bigger deer.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we're going to wrap it up with this because we got somewhere to be. We got one new review that we're going to read. This is from Byron Fields. He said, new to hunting, 5 stars. Hi, my name is Byron from North Carolina. Never been hunting in my life, but I always wanted to go, but never had anyone to take me or show me how. Listening to y'all is helping me learn how to get started. Byron, if you're listening right now, let me tell you, you better tune in on Monday.
Yep.
It's a fantastic episode for a guy like you who's just now getting into it. Very fundamental, very foundational. This is a fun episode, man. I'm excited to release it.
So. And some hot tips to how to get into turkey hunting if you never turkey hunting. Or just
any kind of hunting.
Or any kind of hunting. And listen, you're going to want to go, if you don't have private land, You're going to want to go find some animals on some public land, and it will come in handy for Monday's episode.
That's okay? Right. That's
so
right.
Just take that note. Appreciate everybody who listens to the podcast. Appreciate everybody watching the podcast. Appreciate everybody that's buying all the merchandise. We get some new hats in stock, or working on getting some more hats in stock. Again, get our order of our chocolate chip brown on brown, actually brown and dark gray patch hats, which are a sweet hat. So, again, if you guys want to support the podcast, one way you can do that is just go buy some apparel from us. We really appreciate that. It's awesome getting photos from you all, both with listener success photos and really just photos in general of y'all wearing all the hats. And also, like, we went to NWTF convention in Nashville, seeing a lot of you guys wearing the hats around on the show floor. So, we've got a lot of other expos that we're going to be going to, like the Eco Wild Expo in Mobile, Alabama in May.
Yep.
We've got the Mobile Hunters Expo in June in Dalton, Georgia. And then we also have the World Deer Expo going on in August in Birmingham, Alabama.
July.
Oh, why do I keep saying it's August?
It was August a couple years ago. I don't know.
Is it back in July? Okay,
yeah,
well,
it's in July.
I'm sorry, everybody. Everybody
what are you doing?
Birmingham area. But anyways, we're going to have apparel there. Also going to be coming out some new stuff as well.
Oh, we got some new hats that are going to be coming out. They're going to look awesome.
Yeah, we got some stuff that if you want some of the new products, you might want to come to one that expos because that's where they're going to be launched at. So
yeah,
they sell at the expo. Sorry, everybody else.
Yeah, that's
come,
right.
You come to the show.
You better get them while they're hot.
You have to wait until we get some more in. But anyways, appreciate all the support. Appreciate everybody watching and listening, and we'll catch y'all back here on Monday's episode from the Southern Outdoors and Podcast. You're not going to want to miss it, getting kicking off turkey season content. And other than that, just remember one thing. Y'all stay stuffed.
All right, guys, we're starting to get kind of close to summer here, and you know what my favorite part about summer is? The Mobile Hunters Expo. Y'all heard us talk about it a lot last year, and we actually got to meet a lot of you guys at that expo. Well, we're excited to announce we're going to be there again. This time it's going to be in Dalton, Georgia, June 28th through June 30th. We are going to be there all 3 days. We're going to have a bunch of past podcast guests there. We're going to have a booth where you can come by and grab some merchandise, and I'm sure we're going to be recording all kinds of podcasts there. If you're unfamiliar, the Mobile Hunters Expo is the place you need to be if you are the kind of hunter that listens to this podcast. This show was literally made for you. It is an excellent group of people that are going to be there. A lot of whitetail killers from around the Southeast are going to be there. You're going to get to talk to them, shake their hand, learn from them in person, make some connections. And guys, we get a lot of questions about, hey, which saddle should I get? Which tree stand should I get? What about this piece of gear? What about that piece of gear? How do I meet other hunters who want to hunt the same way that I do? You know, finding a good hunting buddy. The Mobile Hunters Expo is a place for all of that. So you guys, don't miss it. June 28th through the 30th, Dalton, Georgia. We'll see you there.